This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And each day we bring you all kinds of stories: history, music, the arts, public policy, business, and, well, from time to time, just stories about life itself. And every once in a while, we have pitch meetings, and we talk about what we're going to cover, maybe what we need to do that's new. And, well, this was an idea that we were banding around before, and that's going to be bringing us to what we consider our, well, our regular segment we call Off Mic. And that's when you get to listen in to us before the show talking about what we're going to do during the show. And sometimes not even that, just stuff we're arguing about or just bantering about between us. Here we go. What does that mean, now what?
Now what? Now what means, at what point did you reach in your life where you kind of lost your identity because it was rooted in something? I know so many people, if they're sports, especially today, sports is so much of your identity. And then you go to high school, maybe even play college sports, but at some point you're no longer doing that sport. Sure. And then what? You know, what?
And now
you,
what?
What's your identity?
Yeah.
And I know for me, it was incredibly tough because I had no identity apart from my sports or even my friends in high school. So when I went to college, it was a college of 60,000 people. And I remember saying to my friend, I'm so lost here. I was terrified. I didn't want to go to college. I was scared. So I got there and I got kicked out of my first two colleges. And a year after that, I was in drug rehab. And this was a guy who in high school, every single parent wanted their kids to be with me because I never drank, I never did junk food, nothing. I was clean as clean can be, and that was my reputation, and it was also my identity. But when there was that certain anonymity factor and also mm-hmm. the sense of that identity being gone,
yep.
I was in trouble. And so basically, time after that was a time of figuring out, who am I?
Yep.
You know, and so I had to, I remember the first thing I started to do was just read. I'd never read in my life. And I started to just read like Rolling Stone magazine, just stuff that I was interested in. I was interested in music. So I just started reading stuff I was interested in and started to figure out, oh, okay, dance music. So, okay, I'll latch on that. I like this music. That's part of my identity. And then I moved on to like movies and all these things. And I just kept pulling in. And then I started listening to like talk radio. Oh, I agree with this. That's part of my identity. And then it slowly, slowly kept leading me to my faith, which is my ultimate identity.
Well, mine was losing Donna Siafi in high school. That was the only girl I ever dated. And one day she got up and wow. said, you know what? I'm at Rutgers now, and I know you're Mr. Captain of the basketball team in high school. But you see, I'm dating the captain of the football team at college. And it was like, whack. And, you know, she was half of my identity. I always was a sort of one-woman girl. And now what am I going to do? I don't know how to date. I didn't want to date. And I just walked around in a fog. I mean, I didn't even play ball well for like a month. Yeah. And everybody's like, what's the matter? What was I going to do? I'm really sad because my girl busted yeah. me. I'm the captain of the basketball team, for goodness sake. And so that was it for me. My first, you know, what next kind of moment, or, you know, the rug getting pulled out for me. That was Donna Siafi, wherever you are, if you're listening. Thanks a lot. hope everything worked out for you.
Yeah. So what did you do?
I just, you know, I got through it, and then I met a really great girl like about 3 months later, and I was with her straight through college and half of law school, and ultimately she wanted to live in Brazil, and I didn't. Mm. And so then I had another what next moment. Mm. We probably have a dozen of them in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If we're lucky, we have less, but yep. that was mine, Donna.
Did you wow. talk to your dad about it, Lee, or did he notice your drop off in play? Or?
Oh, my dad knew. He didn't even have to ask. He knew, and he just was. You know, when you're like sad like that, you can throw yourself into your work, but something's missing, and it was just something was missing. I couldn't fix it. Mm. I couldn't fix it.
My biggest what now moment was, you know, speaking of work, was actually work related. I'd been working at this radio network for 11-12 years, and you know, I'd bought a house and started a family and started a life, and after a while, this network kind of fell apart, and a lot of us lost our jobs overnight, and we weren't told about it. It was just kind of the rugs pulled out from underneath you. Good luck, you know. A lot of us didn't even get a final paycheck, and I was completely lost there for a while because my job had become who I was as a producer of these big national radio shows, living the kind of lifestyle where you're just kind of breathing the news all day long and booking guests and living in this fast-paced work environment, just to have it stop suddenly, have nothing to do. and not getting callbacks, not having anybody respond to your resume for months and months and months on end. Wow. Eventually, the place tried to make a comeback, and I got hired back there for a while, but then I had to work graveyard shifts for an entire year, and it was just wreaking havoc on my family, and it was making my life just a living hell, basically, because I'd try to sleep all day long, getting really cranky, and it was just going very, very, very poorly until... Until I got a call one day from this guy named Lee Habib.
Yeah. Hey, about that. Right. Well, good. That turned out well. So by the way, yeah. I would bet almost all What Next stories or What Now stories stem from something pretty bad, except maybe, you know, someone wins a lottery. What now? I mean, there could be What Now then, too. I mean, all these people come out of the woodwork and, or you know, they want your money or they want this or that. And, boy, that doesn't end well for so many people who actually win the lottery. Like a whole bunch of them end up broke. What's yours, Alex? What's your what now?
Similar to Jesse. I mean, you know, the person I was working with was passing away. And, you know, you got a family and trying to figure out what to do next. And also blessed to run into you. The other more difficult one was when Kate got pregnant before we were married. And, you know, being a Catholic and, you know, going to daily mass, clearly wasn't doing the right thing and didn't, you know, took advantage of my faith too much. And, you know, it's easy to have that veneer of, you know, I take it seriously. I go to daily mass, I do this and that, but not letting it completely, you know, own your heart, you know, whether you're faith or not, whatever your belief system is, you know, letting it completely rule your life. And, yeah, so that was definitely an awakening.
Well, that's a tough what now. That's a tough what now. I'm glad you did the right thing there, because that often can be a what now in your life too. Your values get hit hard, and now what? You know, what are you going to do when X happens? And well, good stuff, guys. Good stuff. And this is Lee Habib, and that's Off Mic. And by the way, we've all agreed that what now or now what? We haven't fallen down on that one yet, but one of those two is going to be a regular segment on this show. We like it. We're going to start to ask our guests for their what now moment, because we all have them, folks, and hopefully we get through them fast. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. More after these messages. And the sun went down as across the hill, and the town lit up, the world got still. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College. And in this feature, you're about to hear the story of a book considered by many to be second only to the Bible in book sales. It was a book in every American household, yet you may not have even heard of it until now.
In the year 1676... a poor tinker named John Bunyan was imprisoned in Bedford Jail. While he was there, he started to write one of the most famous books in the English language. And everything is told as if it happened in a dream. "I dreamed," he says, "that I saw a man with a book in his hand and a great burden on his back. As he read the book, he began to weep. Then, in a lamentable voice, he cried out, 'What shall I do to be saved?' For he lived in the City of Destruction, which he learnt from his book was doomed to be burnt with fire from heaven, and everyone who lived there would perish in the flames."
The Pilgrim's Progress is a spiritual allegory that follows the path of Christian, an everyman character weighed down by his burden of sin. He leaves the City of Destruction and learns that nothing can remove his burden other than the cross of Christ. The over 3 centuries old novel begins behind bars. Its author, John Bunyan, opens with a sentence of luminous simplicity that has the haunting compulsion of the hook in a great melody.
As I walked through the wilderness of this world, I lighted on a certain place where was a den, and I laid me down in that place to sleep. And as I slept, I dreamed a dream.
A den is a prison. You see, Charles II, the King of England, passed a law forbidding people to preach unless they had a license from the state. But you couldn't get a license unless you agreed with the tax-supported Anglican Church. And Bunyan certainly didn't. On one such occasion, he was asked to stop preaching, and he would be set free. He replied, "If you release me today, I will preach tomorrow." Those now famous words led to a nearly 12-year imprisonment for unlawful preaching. It was during this time that he began to pen his classic work. Published in February of 1678, it quickly became one of the most popular stories of all time. Over 100,000 copies were sold within his lifetime alone. And today, with 250 million copies sold, it is one of the most widespread books in existence. It is a book every American had been exposed to until the last few decades. It has been translated into over 200 languages, and it has never been out of print. As with everything in this story, there is no hiding the truth about who the characters are and what they want with the protagonist. For example, Christian encounters people named Piety, Simple, Sloth, Presumption, Faithful, Talkative, Crafty, or Little Faith. And the readers see each character live up to its name. And throughout the story, Christian is being overcome by his burden of sin, which is literally a massive Santa-sized pack on his back that he is incapable of delivering himself from.
Pilgrim continued upon his way as the enemy of his soul increased his efforts against the traveler.
On his way to the celestial city, Christian is diverted by the secular ethics of Mr. Worldly Wiseman.
How rude of me. My name is Wiseman, Worldly Wiseman. You, of course, will have heard of my family. We are high stock, we are, if I do say so. Oh, yes, yes. Ask us anything, anything you like, and you will find the answer.
Who urges him to lead a practical, happy existence apart from Christ.
Evangelist. Dullards, the whole lot of them. They are pilgrim. Dullards, dullards. His way, utter foolishness.
He instead encourages Christian,
I want to help you,
to seek deliverance from his burden through law and rule-keeping.
I perceive you are a religious man, which is good. Good, very good. The world needs more religious people. It does, Pilgrim, it does.
With the help of Mr. Legality and his son, Civility, from the Village of Morality.
Mr. Legality will show you how to be rid of that burden of yours.
Evangelist meets the wayward Christian and shows him that Mr. Worldly Wiseman, Mr. Legality, and his son, Civility, are false guides, descended from slaves who look to enslave other would-be pilgrims.
When Christians unto carnal men give ear, out of their way they go and pay for it dear. For Master Worldly Wiseman can but show a saint the way to bondage and to woe.
Then as Christian walks along the wall of salvation, he sees Christ's tomb and cross. At this vision, his burden falls to the ground. The journey continues along a road filled with monsters and spiritual terrors. Christian confronts such emblematic characters as Giant Despair, Ignorance, and the demons of the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Often disguised as something that would help him, evil continues to accompany Christian on his journey. But friends Hopeful and Faithful also join him. The two enter the wicked town of Vanity and visit its famous fair called Vanity Fair, which lasts year-round.
Indeed, there are stalls where every foolish trifle in the world is up for sale. In addition, you could buy titles and honors and preferments to high office. and vain pleasures and empty delights of every kind. It is an institution of long standing, artfully set up by the Prince of the Demons, Beelzebub himself, in a place through which all who are pilgrims and strangers in this world must pass when going to the Celestial City. Many, it is feared, get no further on their way.
They resist temptation and are mocked by the townspeople.
Why aren't you buying our merchandise? Buy, buy, buy.
Eventually, the citizens of Vanity imprison Christian and Faithful for mocking their local religion. Faithful defends himself at his trial and is executed, rising to heaven after death. But Christian escapes and continues his journey. With his new companion, Hopeful, they vanquish many enemies before arriving at the Celestial City with the line that still reverberates through the English literary tradition. So he passed over, and all the trumpets sounded for him on the other side. There's no book in English apart from the Bible to equal Bunyan's masterpiece for the range of its readership or its influence on writers as diverse as William Thackeray, Charlotte Bronte, Nathaniel Hawthorne, E.E. Cummings, Mark Twain, C.S. Lewis, John Steinbeck, and even Enid Blyton. Huckleberry Finn speaks for many readers when recalling his Mississippi education. He says,
"There were some books, too, piled up perfectly exact on each corner of the table. One was a big family Bible full of pictures. One was Pilgrim's Progress, about a man that left his family. It didn't say why. I read considerable in it now and then. The statements was interesting, but tough."
The Pilgrim's Progress is likely one of the greatest works of literary allegory that exists. I realize how bold that statement might be, but one only reads the book to find the truth steeped in that boldness. In Hollywood terms, the novel has a perfect arc. While Pilgrim's Progress charts the arc of the Christian journey, it's not limited to the Christian experience. Truly, the brilliance of John Bunyan is realized in his astute understanding and the following portrayal of the human journey and condition as seen through Christian's eyes. Bunyan had a wonderful ear for the rhythms of colloquial speech, and his allegorical characters come to life in dialogue that never fails to advance the narrative. Story is one thing. The simple clarity and beauty of Bunyan's prose is something else. Braided together, style and content unite to make The Pilgrim's Progress a timeless classic. This Day in History.
Great job on that, Greg. Just superb. What a great story. And by the way, The Guardian, well, it puts it up there as one of the 100 best novels in history, and it's one of the most respected newspapers in the UK. And the UK has produced a few good works of art and literature. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.
This is Alex Cortez with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment with our marriage ambassador, Deb Wolniak, the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. If you have marriage questions or stories for Deb, you should email her at info@great-marriages.org, and she'll get right back to you within 24 hours. Deb's group, Great Marriages, was actually founded by another couple, Terry and Mary Kohler. Terry had previously been divorced before he married his second wife, Mary, and saw the devastating impact of divorce and wanted to help others in his own community avoid the same fate. He also knew that psychologists were failing too many couples. They only have a success rate of 28%. Terry decided to experiment with a different model of long and married, successful, joyful couples mentoring younger couples, and their group's success rate, 87%. Today, we're humbled to be joined by another couple who Deb recently met. John and Janine Farrar of Benin Harbor, Michigan. John, Deb, and Janine, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Deb, we'll start with you. How did you meet John and Janine?
Well, this is so fun because we haven't like physically met face to face, but we met over the phone. And it happened to be a couple Saturdays ago. I was at my office, 7:30 in the morning, nice and quiet, and the phone rang. And what's so fun is I love answering the phone and surprising people at times when they don't expect somebody to be there. And what was so great is I met John and Janine over the phone, and they said, hey, this is kind of random, but we heard you on the radio. And that's how the conversation started.
Janine, can you pick it up from there? You were just telling us about you guys listened to the radio one day.
Right. So we were on our way home from running some errands, and John ran into the store with the kids, with a couple of the kids, and I was out in the car. I was listening to the radio, and I was listening to this guy talk about our great American stories. And then this marriage segment came on about that time John came back out to the car. And the thing that really caught us was that they used couple-to-couple mentoring and that they had an 87% success rate, and that really impressed us and excited us.
Had you guys heard of couple-to-couple mentoring before?
Yeah, some. I mean, I've heard of it, and we have counseled with other couples in our area some, so, but we didn't really have a good idea of how to do what we wanted to do.
And so what inspired you to take that next step? You know, I think a lot of folks hear great ideas like what Deb's work's doing, but there's a certain fear we all have, a fear of failure, a fear of starting something new. You know, tell us about how you got over that fear and what inspired you to actually make that phone call to Deb.
Well, we were laying in bed on Saturday morning, and John's like, Janine, I want you to find out about that the people who are doing that couple-to-couple mentoring. With the 87% success rate, I want to know what they're doing and how they're doing it and whatever. And please find the information about it and call them. And so we just got on the internet and started searching until we kind of narrowed it down. And we called Deb and said, tell us about your organization and how we can have something like that in our area.
Deb, is there anything you'd like to add?
Oh, yeah. Well, I just love the fact that these two just said, you know what? Now's the right time to call. I love that about them. I can tell that they not only have a love and appreciation for each other, but even caring for other couples. And that is one of the key qualities that I know great marriages or people who might like to start something in their community about couple-to-couple mentoring might need to consider is, you know, how long have you been married? And do you have a healthy relationship? These are all things that we look for if couples want to start doing mentoring in their community. But the fact that they reached out and said, hey, what is this about was awesome. That's like one of the first steps is knowing the fact that, hey, there's some things out there we might not know yet. Let's explore this and see if we can bring something like that either to our community or start something in our community.
John and Jeannie, let's get back to your, or John and Janine, I'm sorry. Let's get back to your marriage. Tell us about how you guys met in the first place.
We met at a college. We were both going to a Christian college over in Indiana. And this story is probably best told by my wife, so I'll let her take that.
So we were in the chapel, and they had a lot of classes for the freshmen in the chapel. And so you had to sign in, like, at the beginning of every class, but there was a no-saving seats rule. So one day I had two classes in a row, and I went back to the door to sign in for my second class in the chapel. And when I came back, this guy was sitting in my seat where my girlfriend and I had been sitting. And I'm like, excuse me, that's our seat. And he's like, no saving rules. You can sit in this row, but I'm sitting in this seat. And that was my introduction to my husband.
Wow, sounds like quite a warm introduction from him. It must have improved from there.
After that, we just started talking, and he asked me out to Christmas lights. And we just hit it off really well after that first rudeness. And then we are here today.
Well, tell us about your time dating and making that step of deciding to become married.
Well, because we ended up sitting in the same area, we got to know each other a little bit past our, shall we just put it this way, all youthful people think that they have it made up, they got it all figured out, and they know what their parents didn't know. And so after I got over my little arrogance and figured out that wasn't so cool and changed a couple of things, we did get to know each other a little bit better because I thought over that probably wasn't as nice as I should have been.
I want to interject here. So 1 year, we were just friends. We weren't even actually really, you know, dating yet. And I was going home for Thanksgiving because I lived close enough to the college, but John lived like in Maine, so he wasn't going to go home over Thanksgiving. And I'm like, you should just come to my house and have Thanksgiving with my family. And so I called my parents. It was fine and everything. And after that weekend, my mom said to me, Janine, this is the one. And I'm like, Mom, we're not even dating. We're just friends. And she's like, Janine, you've dated a lot of guys, and I've seen them, and I just know this is the one for you. And so I guess my mom had an idea that we were a really good match early on.
You know, that reminds me of just the lack of community in America that we're seeing of parents being able to weigh in, you know, as we have less stable and intact families, having moms and even dads being able to weigh in, you know, into your life like that, or churches or whatever community groups surrounding us to say, you know, right, this is the one, this is someone that I approve of. They've gone through an additional layer of vetting. Can you talk about that a little bit, this decline and how it's hurt marriage?
One of the really neat things about her mother making that statement is before we were actually married, she was going home to have some adjustments done and some braces. And on the way home, it was really foggy, and they got in a bad car accident, and she lost her mother that weekend. So it was really neat that even though her mother wasn't able to be at her wedding and to know our family, that she had a vision for our relationship. And that legacy and connecting, I was just explaining this to one of my children this week. So often we see the problems, and you need to see the problems to solve them. But there's so many times we focus on the problems and we don't start looking for answers. And I think that's part of what the advantage of the, there's an old phrase, the hoary head is a crown of glory, if it be found in the way of righteousness. That when you find people who've succeeded and their hair is great and they've got a little bit of age, we need to counsel with them because they may not have all the answers. They may not know all the new things, but not as much changes as stays the same. And
well said.
Principles that last, they matter.
Well said, John. We'll be back with more. This is our Marriage on the Mind segment. This is Alex Cortez with Our American Stories. More after these short messages. This is Alex Cortez with Our American Stories, and now we're back for our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment with our marriage ambassador, Deb Wolniak, the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, the group whose innovative couple-to-couple mentoring has an 87% success rate compared to 28% for traditional counseling. And today we are humbled to be joined by a couple who recently heard our storytelling here on Our American Stories, was inspired to reach out to Deb to see what they can do in their community. It's John and Janine Farrar from Bennett Harbor, Michigan. Thanks again, everyone, for being here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's dive deeper into your marriage. How long have you guys been married now, John and Janine?
We just had our 29th wedding anniversary in August.
That's pretty neat. I'm jealous. I'm only a couple of years in. I hope we were able to get to that. That's quite a monument. Do you guys have kids?
We do have children. We have...
We have five boys.
Oh, boy.
And eight girls.
Wait, did you say and eight girls?
And eight girls.
Wow, that was a dramatic presentation of that. The way you just added the eight girls after. I was about to ask, hey, did you guys keep trying until you got a girl? But yeah, you got your fair share of girls, too.
No, we got our girl first.
So, John, in the break, you were talking about some of the myths that you guys were thinking about going into marriage. How has your time actually being married exploded those myths?
Well, for one thing, when you open yourself up and you make the other person a person, so that person's more important than your paradigms, it lets you sit back and rethink things. And when we got married, we're a faith-oriented couple, so I didn't realize some of the approach I had, but considering the way we first met, it's not too surprising. But I would spend time trying to teach my wife what I thought she was supposed to be. I had never read anything yet like Mars and Venus or any of those type of books. And the myth that I believed was basically that it's better to dispel the myth. Where I am now, how we try and make decisions in our marriage is we both have the right to veto decisions. The word marriage means to become one. And when we got married, the way we see this and what we've learned to do over the years, and we obviously still struggle with it because we're still two people, but we try and act and make our decisions in unity. When we do a budget, we do a budget, but the budget isn't settled until we both agree. And learning to do stuff like that, instead of one person making this decision and another person making that decision, that's helped us grow together.
So what do you guys do when you guys disagree? Say on that example of a budget, one of you wants to give more to charity than the other, or the other wants to, you know, take this family vacation or get this new car. What do you guys do when you're at loggerheads and you seemingly can't come to an agreement?
We don't spend the money.
We don't, and
that was like a really difficult thing for me. More like with choosing colors for painting. I would suggest a color and he'd say, no, I don't like that. And he would suggest a color and I'd say, no, I really don't like that. I'm like, just let one of us pick the stupid color. And he's like, no, we're not painting until we both really agree and really love the color. And I'm like, what if we can't find something? And he would always say, we will. We don't have to paint today. And every time we've let that work through, which may not seem like a significant example, but the color schemes and the final product that we've come out with have been outstanding. And people have just walked in and said, wow, I love what you did to this room. But it's being patient and being willing to work through it until both of us are happy and both of us are comfortable with the decision that we're making together.
So how long in your marriage did it take for you guys to have this paradigm shift?
10 to 15 years.
Oh, wow. Deb, can you talk about that a little bit, about how this, you know, can give couples who are fighting at this moment, who are only a couple of years into their marriage, great hope that, you know, they can have this paradigm shift over time?
Absolutely. I think one of the things couples have to remember is sometimes these lessons that are life lessons may not happen overnight, but as you continue to strive for them, there's these moments where the light bulb goes on and goes, wow, you know, you see the results of the efforts you put in on just coming together on making a decision as simple as paint. But at the same time, it really sets a tone for making sure you hear each other and respecting each other and even noting each other's differences. So that way, when you do come to conclusion, you have an even better solution than you had before. And we see that very clearly with John and Janine. And that's an awesome, awesome example. I love it.
And if I could just interject here, Al, the longer you work at this, the longer you practice this, the better you get at it. So like maybe the first time it took us several, like maybe a couple of months to come to a conclusion that we both liked. But now we can do it in a couple of hours or a couple of days if it's something really difficult. Just the more you practice working together, the better you get at it.
And let's talk about
book by Dan and Chip Heath called On Decisions, and he brings up in that book that on keys and how to make decisions, I think couples probably should read it, but one of the big keys that would help is he says, you look at a decision, when does this decision actually need to be made? And a lot of times we're too anxious to make a decision and we're putting that ahead of our spouse. And I think that is a big key to that whole struggle, is when you realize the decision doesn't have to be made today or this week, that relaxes the whole conversation because you're not stressed to make the decision.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to interject something too. I love how you two really take time to hear the other person out. And I think younger couples need to remember not to be afraid of that, but to mutually agree that even though it sounds really hard at the beginning and the conversation is maybe feeling a little awkward or stiff, keep trying. And if it helps to write those bullet points down, write them down, look at them, and then just say, wow, you know what? This other person has a very good point. Or we're not quite coming together on this. How then shall we do it? Let it sit for a little bit, come back to it. I like the freedom on that. That's excellent. But know that you can come to a good conclusion.
Let's focus on your community of Benton Harbor a little bit. Tell us about the community, why you guys live there, and how is marriage faring in your community?
We live in a cross-cultural community, and we really enjoy it here because when we lived in our more segregated community before, one of the things we found out is it was harder to get to know your neighbors because we're a classic white American couple. And in our neighborhood we lived before, we would reach out, say hello to new neighbors and connect with them, but they never really engaged. And one of the things I like about this cross-cultural community is even though there's more diversity, there's more connecting. And as we've gotten to know our community more, one of the things that shocked me is one cultural habit in our community, I'm not sure how far spread it is, but there's a lot of couples who will live together, and when you ask them because they're choosing to live together at that point in their life, there's no life commitment or anything, they say they're married. And because of this, you have a lot of children that have grown up over the period of time with 2-3 fathers. And do you guys know a gentleman by the name of Stan Harris? He used to be a well-known karate figure who went to college with us. He commented, and I remembered that probably the hardest thing that destroys this type of community is the fact that children are growing up without that stable reality in their life. They don't know if this person who's guiding or leading them today will even be around in a year. And we want to help other couples and other children to grow up in a home where that instability becomes a thing of the past. We can all make mistakes, but we can also all win.
Well, John and Janine, thank you so much today for sharing your testimony and for being such a guiding light in your community, for standing in the gap, for your interest in helping other couples. And we wish you all the best and your thoughtful considerations of starting a great marriage in Benton Harbor.
Thank you very much, Alex. It was our
pleasure.
Appreciate
you letting us share.
Oh, no problem at all. Our pleasure. This is Alex Cortez with Our American Stories. You've been listening to our Marriage on the Mind segment, as always, with Deb Wolniak, our marriage ambassador. More after these messages.
Every day is not Valentine's, but you make it feel like most of the time. When I'm all alone with you, picking up pieces of my life, sometimes there's ones I just can't find, but they found a home with you. not afraid to be alone, but being alone is better with you. Life is better with you. Whoa, whoa. Life is better with you. Whoa, whoa. Life is better with you. And when I think about the things that we've been through, I know just one thing is true. Life is better with you. Some days are better than other days, but these days, life is better with you. Some days are better than other days.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And that was Elvis Presley's song, It Feels So Right. And his lyrics, It Feels so right, how can it be so wrong? A sentiment we'll now be talking about in the space of charity. And we'll be talking with someone who believes that what feels so right is often so wrong. Bob Lupton is the author of Toxic Charity, How Churches and Charities Hurt Those Who Help and How to Reverse It. A book that shook much of the charitable world into reevaluating their efforts. And today he's with us to talk about his recent follow-on book, Charity Detox, What Charity Would Look Like If We Cared About Results. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Bob, tell us John Perkins' story, how it shaped your and your family's story. Because I think that's the way to best start off this hour. And that was a story about an experience that you're now bringing to this important discussion.
Well, John Perkins is a kind of my mentor. He's a third grade dropout, grew up in Mississippi, sharecropping back well before integration. He's in his 80s now. But John was nearly killed in the civil rights movement and barely escaped Mississippi, went to California, and then had a life-changing experience that convinced him to come back to Mississippi and commit himself to developing a young generation of young leaders who would take their place in helping the poor of that area. John was and still is an inspiration to me. He believes, as I do now, that living among those you serve is clearly the most effective way of breaking the poverty cycle and transforming communities. So it's because of John's influence that I made the decision to move with my family into inner city Atlanta, where I have been serving and trying to make a difference for nearly four decades now.
Well, you know, one of the things that you learned from John's experience was that while he was working with these young people, they would often leave after he helped them and leave the very communities that they were a resource to and for. Talk about that.
Well, I saw the same thing in Atlanta. For about 10 years, I commuted into the inner city from the suburbs and did a lot of work with young people and families, helping them to get out of very bad situations, move out of the projects to better neighborhoods, which was very good for them. But what eventually dawned on me was that as each one of those rising stars left, the community was poorer and a more hopeless, desperate place to live. So what was helping individuals was harming the neighborhoods that we were also trying to help. So John's experience is my experience is certainly mirrored in John's.
You know, there's a pretty remarkable, this is a segue of sorts, but we did an hour on Buck O'Neill. I don't know if you know Buck O'Neill's story, but he was the manager of the Kansas City Monarchs in the Black Baseball League, and ultimately became the first Major League Baseball manager as an African-American. A remarkable story. We found an interview where he was talking about what the old black neighborhoods in the South were like. Now, there was segregation, and it was terrible. But Buck, what Buck was also saying was when all those black folks left those cities and left those towns and left the, and took their store ownership talents and all their talents and fled off to better neighborhoods or different neighborhoods, that it really killed the neighborhoods they'd left behind. Talk a little about that.
Well, yeah, and that same thing has happened in throughout the country. Certainly, Atlanta's been my primary experience, base of operation, and those inner city neighborhoods never have recovered from the out-migration of their more capable neighbors that brought some good stability and education and decent jobs and good models, all of that to their communities. When segregation was in place, they were segregated places, but in the advent of the civil rights movement, that opened up opportunities for families to move out of those inner city communities, and the more capable did move out, and they have many of those communities have never recovered from that.
No doubt. And, of course, we're not ever even suggesting that you want to go back to segregation, but that there were some incredible positive impact, but the negative impact was that folks just, well, they left. And let's talk about helpful versus hurtful charity. Talk about those two things.
Well, certainly helpful charity is what enables people to, first of all, get out of emergency situation. There's certainly emergency care that is needed. But most of the needs in our society are a function of chronic poverty. A series of decisions have been made. And so what chronic poverty needs is a development response. In other words, a pathway to help folks move, take measured steps to move out of their poverty situation into self-sufficiency. What becomes hurtful is when organizations, churches, nonprofits, and others continue to give emergency support to folks that are in a chronic poverty situation. In other words, that's what ultimately produces dependency. And when you give well-intended contributions, clothes, food, and others, to folks that are not in an emergency situation, there are unintended consequences. People, the work ethic is eroded. People's dependency increases. Obsessive dignity diminishes. And so what is intended to be helpful and good ends up being hurtful to the very folks we were wanting to help.
This is Lee Habib, and we're listening to Bob Lupton, Charity Detox. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we continue now with Bob Lupton. And he wrote the book, Toxic Charity, How Churches and Charities Hurt Those Who Help and How to Reverse It, a book that so shook much of the charitable world that many of them had to reevaluate their efforts. And today he's with us to talk about his recent follow-on book, Charity Detox, What Charity Would Look Like If We Cared About Results. I wanted to have you, Bob, talk about a little contrast in studies of what worked in one place and what might not have worked. And in Charity Detox, you tell us the powerful story of a contrast in one neighborhood of Knoxville, Tennessee. Tell us that story.
Well, there's a very fine rescue mission in Knoxville that had been sheltering homeless men, women, and families for many years. And like most shelters, they provided free beds, free clothing, and a safe place to sleep at night. They caught this idea that perhaps their residents, they were overlooking some of the talents and abilities of their residents, and began exploring if they engaged their residents in work while they were there, making beds, mopping floors, working in the laundry, that that wouldn't be a cruel thing. Actually, it would be communicating to them, you have something of real value that you can bring to the table. And no one is so poor that they have nothing to bring to the table. And so they began that process, and it absolutely turned around their model. Today, they have several businesses operating out of the shelter. Every person who makes the decision to come and stay in their program gets a caseworker, and they measure their success by not the numbers of people that fill their beds or the number of meals that they serve, but the number of folks who actually move out of poverty, that become independent, that have their own apartment, that are working full-time jobs, that are paying off bad debts, that are reconciling with their families, et cetera, et cetera. And so that number of folks that are successful are a good bit smaller than the large numbers, the hundreds that did fill their beds, but the outcomes are dramatically different. So they switched from measuring activities to actually measuring outcomes, and it just made all the difference in the world. Now you compare what they are doing to what's happening outside their facility under the large viaduct where the expressway goes over. That's considered Charity Central, and that's where all the homeless gather for free food and handouts that charitable folks, churches, and others bring in there and distribute to the poor. And that creates all manner of chaos in the community. So you got one charity model that is frankly destructive not only to the community but to the recipients, and then right beside it a model that is actually developing people and moving them out of poverty. Quite a contrast.
And I think, you know, if you think it through, and I've often pondered this, but I think people of faith actually have to think about this in many respects differently than people who are secular. And that is that if you think everyone's a child of God and you think everyone has capacities, then your job is to figure out and help them unearth them. And dependency on me is not the question. It's more dependency on God that becomes the question.
Yep.
And so let's, you know, there's a quote that I wanted to read you. You said, I believe now, as I did when I wrote the first Toxic Charity, that the only effective charity is the kind that asks more from those who are being served, not less. And then you got into feed a person once, it elicits appreciation. Feed him twice, it creates anticipation. Feed him three times, it creates expectation. Feed him four times, it creates entitlement. Feed him five times, it produces dependency. Talk about that. I think that's one of the more profound things I've read in a long time. And work it through with me where you came up with that.
Well, I've seen that process, have participated in that process. It's a downward spiral that repeats itself over and over again. It's the result of people with good hearts and good motivations thinking that one-way giving to people in need somehow produces good results. And those, if you live in that environment for any length of time at all, you see that there is a downward spiral that almost always ends in dependency. And so there's a reason why the poor remain poor in our culture. For all of the good that we do, the tons and tons of food and clothing that we collect and distribute to the poor of our nation, you would think that for all of that activity, the poor would be less poor today. But in fact, that poverty needle has not moved in a positive direction. As a matter of fact, it has moved in a negative direction. And I think that it is because we've been giving from the motivation of the heart, but we have not been engaging our minds in the process of giving. So that's what toxic charity and charity detox have been calling for. Let's engage our minds and look for different outcomes to what our charity is intended to do.
And you know, you also are not shy about looking into the Christian missionary industrial complex, as you like to call it. What's your beef with Christian missionaries? And by the way, I've had these discussions with many a group that I think are actually providing what we all call the law of unintended consequences, which is getting the actual opposite result of the thing you desired.
Yeah. Well, the mission trip industry is a very, very big industry these days. We send out about 2 million short-term missionaries every year at a cost of somewhere between $3 and $4 billion. So it's a very big industry. But if you look at the actual outcomes of that, it's more about us and our feeling good than it is about actually helping those we go and serve.
Well, and there was one example in the book where used clothing imports, for instance, caused a 50% increase in unemployment in the African textile industry from 1981 to 2000. And this is because all the, well, I would call them naive missionaries bring in caseloads and boatloads of free clothes, thus destroying
exactly
an
right.
actual industry that creates jobs. And between 1992 and 2006, 500,000 workers in Nigeria lost their jobs due to the inflow of donated clothing. We're talking to Bob Lupton. We're interviewing him on his new book, Charity Detox. And, well, if you want to hear any of this and you want to hear more about what we do and the stories we bring to you, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. And, Bob, you know, what do you say to this? Like this clothing example that I cite from your book, what do you say to folks?
When I have the opportunity to speak with groups that are doing this kind of global outreach, there are a few principles that I lay out to them. Sometimes they don't want to hear it. But one of the things I say is do not give anything away. When you take in suitcases full of clothing and shoes and give away items, it again creates unhealthy dependency. It erodes the economy that is already there. In developing countries, most folk are making their living through little micro enterprises. They're making little pottery and baskets and other kinds of things that they sell to tourists along the road. So they eke out a living that way. Well, when the tour bus comes rumbling up the road, those folks that have a stand near the bus stop, they get all excited because this is business coming.
Yep. This is Lee Habib, and this is Bob Lupton we're talking to. His book, Charity Detox. When we come back, more in-depth storytelling from Bob. And by the way, it'll hopefully make you think about how you think about your charitable giving. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This This is Lee Habib, and we're continuing our interview with Bob Lupton and his new book, Charity Detox. What charity would look like if we cared about results. Ouch. I think sometimes we just don't want to think about it, Bob. I mean, I think sometimes it's that we're not thoughtful enough and that we want to, I think, as you put it before in the last segment, feel better for ourselves, thinking that we've done either God's work or we've done good, and then we can check that box off and we can move on to the next thing. I wanted to share one other thing that you had written that was really remarkable to me. A Texas church went to Nicaragua, built a bunch of houses that the poor then sold when they left. The cash was more valuable to them, and they were used to sleeping in bad conditions. So you say focus on activities versus outcomes. Talk about that.
Well, the Texas group that built the houses, it was a wonderful endeavor. They saw these folks that were living and raising their families in the dump in Managua. You know, they're filthy and following the garbage trucks around, and they were so moved by that that they decided they would do something. So they purchased land and built homes for these families, almost a little village on the countryside that had their own plot of land and clean air. And of course, it was great celebration when the folks moved into their little houses. But a year later, all of those folks had sold those homes and moved back to the dump. They were not farmers. They were recyclers. And they had been recycling materials, usable materials, for generations. And so it's a question of listening more carefully to the needs of those we would serve rather than in bringing in our own ideas of what people need.
Well, we've described some of the problems, and it's the problem with the givers more than the acceptors. So how do we who give become better givers? And how do we become better missionaries and better people of faith? And by the way, for all the secular people living who are good givers, I know my family was, and I grew up in a secular home, and my mom was, I think she tithed better than most tithers, and she was a lapsed Catholic who hadn't gone to church almost her entire adult life.
Yeah. Well, this whole idea of going in and serving people of need has to be reexamined. Most of the work we do could be better done by locals on site. I was talking with a Nicaraguan banker some time ago who went into micro lending, you know, little loans for peasant people to help build up their businesses. And I was asking him how he worked with the churches in Nicaragua. And he said that there are whole sections of his country where he can't do any micro lending at all. He said, my people say, why do we want to borrow money? These American church partners give it to us. He said, why do we want to borrow money to build a church? They build it for us. And then Juan said, they are turning my people into beggars. And so that's the kind of impact that we inadvertently are causing in our attempt to help.
So we're not thinking in that old axiom, teach a man to fish.
That's right.
We're sort of ignoring this. And again, this is a deep biblical principle. Why aren't more business leaders engaged in this kind of work? Because it sounds like, if anything, that's what we need. But then again, to your point before, if a business leader comes in and he's competing against free, well, it's impossible. And by the way, I have this argument with my friends who are progressives in this country. Free is hard to compete with, but free is really bad.
Oh, free is very disempowering. Business people can have a very positive, redemptive impact is if they go in and actually start for-profit businesses that make money with the poor. I have a friend here from Atlanta that was made his living importing Pier 1 type stuff from the Pacific Rim, And he had trouble with quality control, timely shipping. So he said, I can do this better myself. So he and his wife moved to the Philippines, and he opened up a factory there and started manufacturing these household goods. That was 10 years ago. I saw him at a Christmas party this last year and asked him how his business was going. And he said that he had 3,000 people employed. And so I said, that must really be changing the area. And he said, oh, yeah, it is. It's probably created 3,000 auxiliary jobs around his businesses. And he said they do profit sharing. They have health care for all their workers. They have daycare for their workers. And so it has dramatically impacted a poverty culture and given folks a whole new lease on life. They've planted three churches. And so here's a man with an entrepreneurial spirit who wants to do good as well as do well. And it's transforming a whole culture. Well, it would take, you send 50 missionaries into the same place for 50 years and you wouldn't accomplish the same kind of positive impact that one committed businessman can do using his God-given ability to create wealth. So the business people are very much needed as the new missionaries on the field.
Yeah, but they don't.
If we want to change poverty.
Yeah, we don't need their money. We need their talent. We need their
Right.
We need their investment, which is a very different thing than a gift.
Absolutely. Yep. It's creating jobs. It's enabling folks to use their abilities, their hard work, to take measured steps to move out of poverty situation into what I would call shalom, a sense of peace, prosperity, well-being, community, which I believe is God's desire for all of us.
You know, when I have these conversations with folks I really love, my pastor, others, and I talk about capitalism and how important it is that we people of faith. And, you know, and there it is, the parable of the talents. So, there it is in the word. What we do with our money, do we hide it? Do we put it out into the world? Well, what capitalists do is they take that capital, they put it out into the world. They don't hoard it. They don't spend it on themselves. Why are people of faith so resistant to this thing called capitalism? And the two go hand in hand so beautifully. Look what it's produced here in this country.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I think one of the reasons why we don't hear messages that reinforce the importance of wealth creation is because our pastors have gone to seminaries rather than business schools. They don't understand how business and the market works. I've talked to many very wealthy business people, and to the person, they have said, my church just doesn't understand me, or my pastor doesn't understand me. They warn against the dangers of wealth, the seductiveness of mammon, but don't ever preach that wealth creation is a spiritual gift under the lordship of Christ, being able to create wealth, which is to say, create jobs that enable a society to flourish. They don't see that as a godly thing, nor do they celebrate those that have that gift of wealth creation.
But, no doubt.
But it is certainly biblical.
No doubt. And we're talking to Bob Lupton, his new book, Charity Detox, What Charity Would Look Like If We Cared About Results. And we'll finish up our conversation after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're closing out this hour, and it's a terrific hour, the conversation with Bob Lupton. And we're interviewing him on his new book, Charity Detox, what charity would look like if we cared about results. And Bob, where we left off is I'd wanted to ask you about this thing called microlending, because it's everywhere. You know, Muhammad Yanis won a Nobel Prize for this idea, and it's very popular amongst what I would call the NGO crowd. Talk about why you're not a big fan of microlending, and what are its deficiencies?
Well, microlending are small loans to peasant people to help them increase the size of their businesses. It may be a little loan to help a woman buy a little bit more fruit to sell in her stand, or a mother to buy another treadle sewing machine so she and her daughter can both sew garments to sell. And so micro-lending is very important to enable folks to live at a better survival level. And so micro-lending is helpful. But micro-lending does not move people out of poverty. It doesn't create wealth. And in order to create wealth, in order for people to thrive, we know this in our own business climate, a business has to come to scale. That means that it's more than just what I can produce with my own hands in one day. I have to have others working for me. I have to mechanize. I have to streamline. So a business has to grow in order to create wealth and make and employ more people. Well, micro loans do not enable people to move from cottage industry into full scale business. And the reason why is if their business grows, it comes onto the radar screen of the government. These small businesses, micro enterprises, are a part of an informal economy. So that means they don't pay taxes, they don't register with the government. But as soon as they get larger, they do have to do that, and which means they've got to fill out a lot more government forms and be mechanized and worry about marketing and packaging and
The health care.
Yeah, making sure that their product is safe, which governments require. Well, in order to do that, it's a quantum leap for someone that has a little fruit stand to move into a full-fledged business. And so what they need in order to become to actually create wealth are the kinds of talents that we have in our pews. Those are the business people that run businesses, and we do it better than anybody else in the world. We call it SMEs, small medium enterprises, and that makes up 80% of the new jobs that we create every year in this society. It's 50% of the GNP. So we do it very well. We just haven't been using that talent to enable peasants in a struggling country to use those, develop those talents so that their businesses can grow beyond micro into SMEs. So that calls forth a whole different kind of missionary. That is business as mission. And if we're going to alleviate poverty, our Christian business people are going to have to engage in the process.
Now, Bob, in Charity Detox, you movingly tell John Coors' story. And I think the most important lesson from that story was his humility. I mean, it really moved us over here in our studio about what he was doing wrong, a humility that is hard for actually any human being to admit to himself, but a humility we must all bring into this discussion if we truly care about the poor. Share it with us, John Coors' story,
well,
if you can.
John Coors is a fine Christian man, has been very successful. And he had the idea that there are whole sections of this world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, that just have, there's no electric grid at all. So they live on fires that they collect and cook and heat over. And he came up with a strategy to provide very, very inexpensive energy, kind of propane tanks, that would allow people to have light in their homes and be able to cook without the health problems that smoky wood creates. That idea seemed like a good one, and he implemented that in many villages, but over time realized that as soon as folks, as soon as their propane tank ran out, they didn't come to refill it. They went back to gathering and burning sticks. And so John realized that the only way that this dream, he called it circles of light, the only way that it could grow would be if you were going to subsidize it. And as a businessman, he said, no, subsidizing folks does not make them strong and independent. And so he pulled the plug on that, which was a very courageous thing to do. And so he said, what people need are jobs. And so he has changed his whole strategy, is going after other wealthy families to partner with African entrepreneurs who have good business skills but just don't have the capital and the connections to enable their businesses to thrive. And so he's using his influence to develop those kind of partnerships that will enable African businesses to thrive, which means that they will create jobs, which is the only way people move out of poverty.
No doubt. And you know, let's talk about, in closing out this discussion, you know, obviously there's capital, and we all know that kind of capital, and that's money. And what people are looking for in the for-profit world is a return on capital. And that's a word called profit, which generates all kinds of accountability and a great standard and system of measurement. We in America, well, at least most of us, understand how important profit is and capital. But let's talk about the human kind of capital. And I think that's the capital that matters most in the 21st century. You need the capital, that's the money. But without human capital, what do you got? Talk about that.
Well, what we have in this country in abundance is not only know-how in how to run successful businesses. We have motivation and access to monetary capital. And so better than anybody else in the world, our entrepreneurial ability enables us to thrive. That's personal capital. We also know how to hire well, how to train well, how to retain a workforce, have a healthy workforce. We know how to do all those things. What is missing in developing worlds are, you call them the missing middle. There's a whole large segment of people who are scratching out a living just in micro businesses. And then there's a small band of wealth at the top. In Nicaragua, it's 11 families that control about 90% of the wealth of the country. So that's typical of developing countries. So what we have is we've got the wealth of ability and know-how and experience that if we bring it into those developing countries, we can have a profound effect on helping folks move economically, socially, spiritually out of poverty.
I'm going to leave with one quick question. If you could give us about a minute on this, Bob, this idea of re-neighboring. What is re-neighboring?
Re-neighboring is deciding that the most effective way to end poverty in a community is to end the isolation, which means that we as committed people committed to be neighbors, particularly among those in need, actually relocate and become neighbors in places of need, and join with folks that are struggling. And from the inside of the environment, we work to affect positive change. That more than any other single strategy in this country is a poverty alleviator that changes neighborhoods when committed, caring, capable, connected people become neighbors.
Well, Bob Lupton, thanks so much for this book. We'd love to have you on regularly. We do a lot of talk about generosity in this country because there is tremendous amounts, but we have to talk about efficacy and effectiveness too. Thanks for your book, Charity Detox, and thanks for spending the hour with us.
Nice to be with you.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear this and everything we do.